Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Topher, Principal Architect of Topher Architecture, and you're listening to New Books Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network dedicated to architecture and its publications. If you have any suggestions on authors who you'd love to hear me speak with next, feel free to send me an email at btopher@topherarchitecture.com. Today's guest is Michael Benedict to talk about his book, Architecture Beyond Experience. Michael teaches design studio and architectural theory at the University of Texas at Austin, where he holds the Halbach Chair in Urbanism. He not only writes and engages in academic research, but he also practices architecture. Michael, thank you very much for being here with me today. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Brian. Thank you for inviting me.
So before we begin, can you tell the audience a little bit more about yourself?
Well, I've been a lover of architecture for as long as I can remember, but a practitioner and then mostly a teacher and writer about architecture. Since 1975, I went to Yale graduate school, came down to Texas at that time, and have loved being here ever since.
Great. And so we can just jump right into it. And so the book is called Architecture Beyond Experience, and it's broken into three parts, the third part being Architecture Beyond Experience. However, there's the first two that kind of build on quite a bit of a framework to kind of get us there with a lot of explanations. And so I was wondering if we could start right at the first part, the idea of locating the sacred. And I think it's worth mentioning for the listeners that when you say sacred, you're not necessarily referring to it as a theological standpoint.
Well, it is a theological standpoint, depending on how broadly you understand the term theology. But you're right, it does start at a statement about, should we call it ultimate values or the spiritual experience in architecture. I'm a member of a group called Architecture, Culture, Spirituality Forum. And I attended many of the meetings, and I found a lot of a brotherhood, if you will, with a group of architects who thought that sort of commercial and functional reasons for architecture were not motivational, and not sort of deep enough to really take architecture to, should we say, the next level. So I thought that these first questions, like why do architecture, what is the ultimate justification for doing it, is it purely functional? Clearly not. There are psychological and ritual reasons to make buildings, and that these are the ones really that ought to be carrying architecture forward as an art. I had some differences, shall we say, with most of the people of that organization, in that my book previous to this was actually a book of theology called God is the Good We Do. And it's a description of a God that was not a creator or all-powerful or unified, but rather more like a process theological God, that is, a God who comes into being with our actions, that we are responsible for as much as responsible to. So for a lot of people, that sounds rather atheistic. For me, not at all. And I had long been a fan of a philosopher named Martin Buber, who comes close to saying the same sort of thing, as did philosophers like Alfred North Whitehead and Samuel Alexander and some others. Also, Niemann, who was the mentor of Martin Luther King, and so forth. So it turns out it wasn't such an original idea, but I put together a whole new way to think about it. And it struck me that this is the kind of God an architect could believe in, because architects are nothing if not morally creative agents. And I saw in the ability and the genius of architects to make, quote unquote, something out of nothing, a little bit like that of an artist or a musician, to take raw materials and create something in a very general way divine, meaning ennobling, creative of community, psychologically satisfying, and something that would last beyond a single lifetime, as well as be part of every moment of consciousness. So I thought the right way to start a discussion of architecture is by putting, so to speak, your theological cards on the table. So the first few chapters attempt to do that. And the first few chapters claim, and you can believe it or not, you'd have to read them, I guess, that there is a theology operating inside of architecture. It's just not one we talk about.
That's a very good point. And so in the beginning chapters, you mentioned, again, when I say it's not theological, I think when you first hear sacred, you think of kind of the design of a church. And so you bring up a good point that almost any designer, while they don't go out to do that, almost every architect tries to put in a higher ceiling that's necessary, some beautiful water fixtures. They try to get people gathering. And you make the point that that is all sacred design, no matter what building you're doing it for.
Yeah. Also, you know, symmetry, mysterious light from above, magical effects like levitation, you know, showing no signs of dirt, the super cleanliness. Once you get into it, you suddenly realize, wait a minute, these are all tropes of sacrality.
Absolutely. You had mentioned, you know, part of that group you were kind of discusses some of the shortcomings of defining architecture, et cetera. You know, you bring up another good point that I know in my personal practice, I've never once had a client want to have a sacred design. And you spell out that the clients are usually asking for efficiency, style, and profit. I would say it's usually efficiency and profit. Yet, I think it's probably not a controversial idea that any client would actually want all of these, we'll call them sacred design aspects.
I mean, you know, the church is a special kind of house in a way. But anyway, I try not to rest the entire book, you know, on top of a theological claim, but I do think that was the place to start. And as you know, I move on to the idea of of experience as being the place that things came to rest for the architectural argument. In other words, the religious experience or the spiritual experience, the experience of space, the experience of time, the experience of your own body, the experience of a particular moment. So there's a sort of a huge literature grew in the phenomenology of architecture that said, yeah, the real reason to do architecture is to enhance the human experience. So I think the religious impulse in many ways ends up being transmuted, if you will, into a sort of an obsessive interest in experience. And that comes out to be something like spatial experience or experience of light or the experience of your own body, the experience of space. And the word experience, I think, in the last 20 years or so, has come to stand in for architects' natural interest in the sacred or the spiritual. And I think for most people, talk of architectural experience or to speak of architectural experientially satisfies the sort of the instinct that there has to be a psychological or spiritual dimension to the best architecture.
And obviously, experientialism is a big part of the book.
Experientialism is the way I say it, yeah.
Yeah, obviously, it's a big part of the book. It's not only in the title, but it's kind of brought up throughout. And so maybe we'll cut back to that, so I'm not asking you to summarize the book in one sentence. You bring up the idea of kind of psychological and kind of a few different... there's quite a few mention of non-architectural kind of theorists in here. You had mentioned Martin Buber. You know, you talk about Buddhism, and then a concept I think we would like to hear more about, the idea of a solipsism. Hopefully I said that right. you know, again, concepts that I've never read in an architectural book, but I think a good case is made on their relevance here. And again, I just threw three of them. I guess maybe we could start with Martin Buber because you had mentioned him by name. The idea that, you know, every phenomenon is based on bonds between two subjects, we'll call them. I know that's a little vague, but, you know, and you bring up a concept that I think the listeners would benefit to hear more about, the idea of I, you versus I, it.
Okay. Right. So Martin Buber was probably the only philosopher I had read. And I read him first, by the way, when I was a teenager and didn't understand a word of it. I went back to it in my 20s and I understood a little more, and then back in my 40s. So he's definitely a philosopher I had to revisit many times. And now in my advanced old age, I think I finally got it. So Buber talks about two attitudes towards the world. And he uses a double word to describe these two attitudes. One is I, it, and the other is I, you, or sometimes in the literature it'll be referred to as I, thou, but from the German it's more like I, you. And that describes the relationship between yourself and any other thing, object, creature, entity in the world. In the I-it relation, you think of the other person or animal or whatever as being useful to you or not, as being dangerous to you or not, edible or not, even beautiful or not. It's a very objectifying experience. I shouldn't even call it an experience. It's a relationship between you and the object. But in IU, he claims it's a different kind of relationship. In IU, you actually address the object as like when you say hello to it, or you feel like it addresses you. And when you address yourself to an object and you try to look into it, try to see what kind of subjectivity it has, judge whether it's responding to you, you open yourself to it, it opens itself to you maybe, but you certainly open yourself to it and become a little vulnerable. It sounds a lot like love, but it's actually not. It could easily be hate. But it is, the IU relationship is it's pre-love, shall we say, or it's before it turns into love or hate. It's simply being open to the other in a way that it is not. So that was a distinction which takes a little bit of practice to sort of get the hang of. But somewhere in that book, a book called I and You by Martin Buber, he takes the word experience and he says, all experience is I, it. And that struck me quite deeply. I thought, all experience is I, it. According to Buber, I, it generates experiences. And these experiences become stories, movies, accounts we give each other, and ways that we judge things and weigh things against each other for their advantage or disadvantage. The word he uses for IU, though, is encounter. In IU, you encounter the other. And that encounter has a totally different feeling and a totally different moral consequence. And that started me thinking about what does it mean to encounter a building? What does it mean to encounter a piece of furniture? What does it mean to encounter a tree or a landscape or an animal in the landscape? Like what would it mean to have an IU relation to a building? And could ordinary people have that? Could designers have that? Do designers have that? Do artists have that? And my thought was, absolutely. Absolutely, especially an artist's relationship to what she's doing, is not I it, it's I you. Hmm. And I wanted to explore that difference.
Thank you. Great explanation. You know, as a firm owner myself, I think it's an interesting aside that you mentioned almost briefly that, you know, a lot of self-employed and young architects, if they're not careful, they'll view everything as a I-it relationship. Kind of, you know, everything is a possible advantage to further their own business.
Right. Or the client's business. I'm not saying they're going to be egotistic, but everything has to be weighed for the advantage and disadvantage. I mean, when you hear architects saying, I'm going to put the building here like this, that, or the other, and I'm going to capture this view, and then I'm going to capture that view, that always starts making me the chuckle. Because, like, really? Is a view like a tiger? You know, how clever do you have to be to capture a view? Not very. You just have to put a window in that direction. You know, it's like... I don't know. Actually, I do enjoy the interactional idea of capturing, a view that's like a tiger. But it's all very instrumental, put it that way. And it's all very, there's definitely a payoff.
Absolutely. And so, of course, there's so much more in the first part. I do want to kind of touch on all three. And so moving on to the second part, the idea of fabric of glances, and I don't want to keep quizzing you on your big concepts, so maybe we'll break it down a little bit and we'll get to it.
Okay, sure.
I know that part starts with something very interesting. You have a chapter entitled The Critique of Environmental Study, Behavior Study. I've had probably three different authors on the show that discuss their findings and research they've done for environmental behavior study. And so I personally find it very interesting that you make the claim, and again, if I'm misunderstanding, please correct me, but you're making the claim that despite all this advance in research and data, architects are kind of, for the most part, ignoring a lot of this.
Yeah. Well, do you think I'm wrong?
I don't disagree.
Yeah.
I don't want to.
Because, you know, there is a part of me that's an environmental behavior study guy. My research with ICIVIS, in fact, started out in that genre. It was like, how do you affect people's judgment of spaciousness? How do people move around buildings? How do you design hospital wards so that doctors can see the nurses and the nurses can see the patients? How do people walk around in museums? How do you lay out cities and shopping centers? All this was work with ICIVISTS, and there are thousands of papers online about it. So all of that happens, it's still going on, within the context of environment behavior studies. And that's actually where most of this is. And over the years, I've come to wonder why it is that architects are not at all interested in it.
Yeah, and so when I say I don't disagree, the answer I was going to give is, from what I can see, at least again, it's my own personal, medical facilities and schools in particular have truly embraced it. It's almost like dogma, but it seems like, at least in my mind, every other building type does completely ignore it and does not. You know, I don't know if you have a different opinion on schools and medical facilities, if you think everyone's ignoring it or...
No, I think, listen, I've not spent a lot of time in firms that design, you know, prisons, hospitals, and schools, which, by the way, somehow seem to go together in the same firm. And I'm not sure that they use all the studies that have been done. But it's a mode of practice that likes to appeal to evidence and likes to appeal to science, and I think EBS or environment behavior studies are definitely locked into the I-it scientific worldview, and I suspect that the reason architects are not interested is because temperamentally architects are not scientists at all. I think we might be engineers up to a point. But I do think we're all closer to artists than anything else, even though we have to do spreadsheets and reports and make sure the concrete's good. You know, I mean, I'm not saying we're like sculptors, but in our heart of hearts, we trust our intuitions, we trust our eye, we look for feelings. We try to achieve magical effects whenever we can. And I think that that's not available in the literature of environmental behavioral studies. Like that whole perspective on the world is missing. And I don't think architects are going to listen to it unless they have to, unless it's a professional requirement or legal requirement. Yeah.
So in your opinion, if that element was added to some of the papers, studies, case studies, could it garner some more interest, or would we still go with our gut instinct?
Well, Brian, I think you've put your finger on the bridge I'm trying to build, which is I actually invented many of those tools that are being used, as you said, and I'm super proud. But actually, there's more to ICIVIS and the fabric of glances and membranes and all that stuff that's in the second part of the book. There's much more that's, quote, very loosely speaking, spiritual inside of those concepts. And my thought is, when architects can see that, or can feel that, that these tools will become part of what the artist side of the architect can see. And I think you can see in the book there's some very visually beautiful illustrations of what's revealed when you apply these tools.
Absolutely. And to the listeners, hopefully they will take a look at those graphics after this interview. And so you've actually mentioned this term ICIVIST a few times, and I know it, and I know there's it's throughout the book, but you do kind of focus a little bit in this part, the idea of, I'll take it right off your chapter title, kind of optic arrays, the idea of what people are looking at. And that sounds so simple at first, but I think you've proven that it's its own field of study, to be honest.
Gosh, man, with everything, the more you look, the more you see. It's like, art is obsession, and this is a sort of an obsession. Obviously, we walk around in the world, we see it in 3D, and as we move around, what we see changes. So ICIVIST is a technique not entirely invented by me, but really sort of unpacked by me back in the early 90s, 80s and 90s actually, where the idea is that you take a point in a plan of a building or it could be a garden, doesn't matter, and you just draw in plan all the space that can be seen from a given point. Now, obviously, if you look into the sky, you can see the stars, so it's infinitely large. But you just take a couple hundred feet as your natural world, and you just draw the shape of the volume of the space that's visible. And the minute you have that shape, which is called an ICIVIST, which is the sum of all the points visible from a given point, suddenly you realize that that shape has a size and a shape, and that it changes from point to point, and that math can be done that quantifies that shape and quantifies the nature of it. So there are different boundary conditions, there are occlusive planes, there are surfaces, and there turn out to be up to a dozen different statistics that can apply to what that shape's doing. You can then put those measures all over a plan, and you get a field picture of space in which the quality of the space is definable by a huge bunch of numbers or colors. And so you can actually see the quality of space changing from one part of a building to another part of the building. And it turns out that those qualities guide our behavior and predict our feelings quite well. And so the middle part of the book is all that stuff laid out as best I can.
Absolutely. So you had mentioned that sometimes the environment behavior study is missing a graphic portion. I know the diagrams you present, I think, in my mind at least, are somewhat of that graphic. Because I will say the definition of ICIVIST didn't land with me until I saw until I saw the graphic. So.
Yes, exactly. Right.
And so one question I have.
And my belief, of course, is that that's how architects think. I mean, I'm an architect. I love architects and my brothers and sisters. And we think with drawings, we think mm-hmm. with diagrams. And that's what I try to do.
Absolutely. And so something else you present graphically and that I'd like to hear just a little bit more elaboration. So there's this idea of the isovist, which I think you just explained very well. And then in a few chapters later, you bring up this idea of a presence field. And I guess for me, my personal question is it does seem like there's a bit of a difference between the two, but at first glance, in my mind, they seem very similar. You know, what is kind of the difference between presence field and an isovist?
Well, the term you used earlier called the fabric of glances is an essential sort of link. Yeah. So an isovist at a given point in an environment is all the points that are visible from that point, okay? But you won't make any distinctions if something's far away or close, or whether it's to your left or to your right. If it's in your field of view, you're in. You're in the isovist as a potential. But people don't look at everything with equal interest at all. There are special points that we look at. And one of the things that we look at most closely is other people, okay? So you could imagine if you had the technology, you could watch what people are looking at. You could have like little beams coming out of their eyes. And in the book, I actually do it. There's a video embedded in the book where you see someone doing that. So you imagine people walking around in a building with eye beams coming out of their eyes that flicker and look at things. And mostly look at other people. So when there's two or three people in a room, they mostly look at each other. Sometimes they avoid looking at each other, depending on their relationship. But if you imagine those eye beams leaving a trace, let's say they're bright for a second and then they slowly fade, right? And you just take everyone's looking and where they're looking and build it up over time, a kind of a cloud would appear, a sort of a bony spider web maybe. Unclear what that would look like exactly. But that's a kind of something that exists inside of isovists, is another whole structure. And I give it the poetic name, the fabric of glances. The fabric of glances is like the history of where everyone was looking when they move around in a space. And the dream was, through computation, maybe someday through photography, one would be able to actually see that. You would track people moving around and so forth. But unfortunately, that technology doesn't exist right now. We can do eye tracking in real time, but the equipment is cumbersome and we can't, and if you put two or three people in a room and say, you know, don't worry about the shit that's on your face tracking your eyes, it's not going to work. But you can do something else, and this is where the presence field comes in. You can say, look, where people are looking depends somewhat on which way their shoulders are facing, which way their head is facing, because people's faces are attached to their heads, which are attached to their necks, which are attached to their shoulders, to their hips, and to their feet. And which way someone is looking, you can probabilistically look at with probability, a little bit more math. And those create presence fields. And a presence field is the probability of what you're looking, what direction you're looking. And so if you take, let's say, and in the book there's a picture of a real cocktail party, photographed, and I put everyone in plan, and I just create the field of where they're probably looking, and you can see the fabric of glances sort of congealing in the way people are standing around and the attitudes they're taking towards each other. So for me, the presence field is the beginning to look at the realm of the in-between. It's beginning to look at space not as empty, but as full of communication, and trying to sort of understand social grouping at this abstract kind of aesthetic level.
Thank you very much for explaining that. I think that kind of helps clear up the two. It's interesting you mentioned that the eye tracking is cumbersome. There was another guest on that kind of also hinted that it's not inconclusive. There's some issues. There does seem to be some generalizations. I think you make the argument with the painting that anyone who looks at that painting honestly glances at the eyes, mouth, and heads of the three people first, and then the rest is kind of window dressing. So it's interesting to think about all this being applied to architectural design, obviously.
Yeah.
And so you had actually mentioned, this is a perfect segue into the third and final part, you had mentioned the idea of the in-between, which you have an entire chapter dedicated to. And so the case you make there that is, of course, architecture is always compared to, you know, technical art. It kind of encompasses a lot of different art. But you have made the case that photography in particular is a friend of art. There's a quote from you, a friend of architecture and vice versa. And so you had mentioned the, if I understood you correctly, you're mentioning the possibility of using photography to better track people's movements and eye movements. Is that correct?
Yeah, yes, yes. But, okay, so this takes us back, Brian, to an earlier point that you had me make, actually. I could see some people, certain sort of engineering or research temperaments, looking at membranes, which I haven't discussed, but anyway, the fabric of glances, the order of shoulders, all these eye tracking, and thinking, oh man, here's about 50 PhDs right here. We're going to do this. We're going to watch people. We're going to see where they're looking. We're going to create these patterns. We're going to quantify them. We're going to make predictions. We're going to go into hospitals and schools and prisons and you know, put the data down and give it to designers to design better things with. I think that's fine, but it's not what I wanted to do. It's because for me, these entities, these concepts have a power of their own, a kind of a psychological or art value or design power, which I think architects can access at a much higher level than just sort of technical studies of where people are looking. Because once you understand these concepts, your actual sense of priorities change. It's like you actually start to think like that. And then the rest of your architectural training sort of kicks in. And so the second part of the third part of the book, I should say, is me showing that some of our greatest architects have done that in, you know, in their own way. So there's Aldo Van Eyck and Louis Kahn and Carlo Scarpa and Frank Gehry, and there's hundreds of examples that I could have used, but and Le Corbusier a lot. You think, what? These guys never had these concepts. They never knew what an isovist was. And I'm saying true, but this is the intuitions are old. The intuitions are deep in the soul of architecture, shall I say.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
I want to come back to that just real quick. You had briefly mentioned membranes, and I actually think it's worth elaborating that for the, you know, short for mental membranes. This the reason it sticks out to me is it had the, in my mind, the best anecdote to try to explain it.
Oh, well, you tell it.
The idea of an invisible, I'll simplify it, of an invisible barrier, which at first sounds a little theoretical, but the example you provide is, you know, if you have a plate of food and you put it below a toilet lid without touching the water and bring it out, no one will take that food if you offer it to them, even though nothing happened to it.
Exactly,
and I think that
is right across the toilet, or even the sink actually will work. But you realize that the world in general has invisible surfaces across doorways, extending from major pieces of furniture. I think the average architect would say, "Oh, you mean thresholds," and to some extent that's true. It is a threshold, but it's. These things are much more ubiquitous. And when you, as an architecture teacher, Brian, and anyone who teaches design, you find yourself coaching students to extend the lines of objects into space so that you're always on this side or that side of the table. You're always on this side or that side of this room, right? Even though that's an invisible boundary, the assumption is that people feel them and step through them and frame themselves theatrically with respect to these boundaries. And the question is, why? What makes them strong? What makes them weak? What makes them work? When do they not work? How much can you weaken them before they're gone? And you know from the book, I worry that too much open planning and free planning completely destroys these embrains. And the absence of embrains makes it impossible for people to perform their lives using a dramaturgical model of me and you and here and there and so forth. So, yeah, that whole chapter turns into sort of a defense of somewhat classical architecture.
Yes, and you had mentioned the idea of rooms, and I think we inadvertently kind of glossed over a big concept of the book is kind of the idea that the interaction between people, rooms, and things, things being artifacts, people being animals, or rooms being spaces. And so you had mentioned rooms, however, and rooms kind of get special attention in this chapter. You know, if you say the word room, everybody instantly has an image comes in their mind. They have a definition. But again, you and many others make the argument that the interplay between rooms and people's interaction with rooms is kind of a big part of what architecture really is.
Yes.
Even if you don't think of it that way.
Yeah, and it's an art we've kind of lost a little bit. Yeah, well, you know, this is the open plan. I mean, I don't know, I happen to be, not to get too personal, I happen to be in the throes of buying a house for my mother-in-law. And inexpensive. And, you know, a world without architects is opening up before me. And the open plan house is like a site of destruction.
Well, it's interesting because if you were to design an office in the last 5 years, again, the dogma is it needs to be open office plan.
Yep. Well, listen, there's open and there's open. I don't think I'm advocating that everyone should be in a sheetrock box with a little hole in the wall or a window and a door that seals tight. No. Not at all. But, you know, nor do I think a big fluorescent pancake with desks floating around and cables on the floor is the answer. So clearly the art of architecture is being clear about what space is yours and isn't, where you present yourself one way and where you present yourself another. And these things have to be clear and they have to be socially structured. So one of the notions in the book is there's definitely rules about how people interact in space. Some of them are natural, some of them are just custom. But there are rules about how rooms associate in space. Like you treat a room as though it was a person. And you say, are these rooms associating with each other the way people would if the rooms were people? I know that sounds a little nutty, but well, hopefully if you read the book, you get it.
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned teaching. You know, I think one thing that I probably harp on more than anything is the idea that if you design a floor plan and the exterior of the building separately, it's always obvious and it always suffers. And I won't name any famous architects who are more famous and successful than me, but you've mentioned that you'll have a beautiful sculptural building with a stack of rooms on the inside, and the ones on the exterior are kind of unusable because it's all triangulated and curved.
Right, because it happens to be pushed against this expressive exterior. Right.
And so, again, you know, I won't name anyone, but so I agree with you. You make the case that, you know, if the design of a room is architecture as well. The architecture is not a shell of a building that you stuff things in. It's everything.
Right. And, of course, I'm borrowing from Louis Kahn. I think A Plan is the Society of Rooms. It was probably, I quote him maybe, six, ten times in the book. And every time I go, hey, do you realize if that's true, or if you want to make it true, I mean, you can ignore it. You know, this is not religion; it's just architecture. But if you go with it, there's lots of consequences. To plan as a society of rooms, then every room is like an individual. It has to have a front and a back and its own light, its own services, its own dignity. It associates with other rooms. I mean, a plan as a society of rooms is an amazing idea. Yeah.
And so, again, unfortunately, there's so many parts of this book that we're just kind of scratching the surface on. Can't cover it all. As we kind of wrap this up, one final thing I think is worth mentioning is, you know, Scarp was actually one of my favorites. So you picked out one of my favorite projects in here, the stairs at the Olivetti showroom. The idea, and I think anyone who studies architecture is familiar, you know, his attention to detail, his detailing of joints that most architects kind of don't care about. But you kind of bring up the point that I think is valuable for him or any of the, we'll say, the masters we study, and that is sometimes they aren't the greatest example. And you make the point here that, you know, he spent years on a building, he worked for years with builders, and he had a teaching salary. Whereas the kind of the sad, I'll say sad reality is, as a practicing architect, you know, you kind of can't spend years on a project, no matter how beautiful it needs to be.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And again, some of the other architects you've named, kind of the same thing. They've had some projects and beautiful examples that are tough to follow, especially in today's, I guess we'll say, architectural reality.
Yeah, it's very, very true. And I would accept that as a critique, I suppose, of my book, is in that to follow in its thoughts and to take seriously the precedents being offered by the architects at sites is not easy if you are a hardworking corporate architect trying to put reasonable buildings out as fast as possible on time and on budget. It's a harsh world in which to do really excellent architecture. But I feel like my role in life, I suppose, is to keep the message alive of what the art of architecture is capable of.
Absolutely. And I guess I wasn't exactly offering a critique. I would make more of the point that it's just something you have to jump into. Like, you can't, it has to be something you're thinking of all the time, not something you try to incorporate at the very end, for example, I guess.
Right. And I have to say, as a teacher of design studio, as you know, if you've done it, Brian, it's more like being a coach. It's more like coaching than actual like teaching. But I teach these things in studio, and my kids do very fine buildings, I have to say, and I think my peers will agree. And part of it's because I inject these thoughts into the conversation. I don't make them jump hoops. We don't do, you know, incredible scientific experiments. It's just, hey, think about this. And if you do, it changes things. And my fervent dream is as these students go on and become part of, super efficient firms, where there's not really time to ponder these things, but that maybe it doesn't take much to just add them to the flow of what makes a building a little better than it needed to be. And then maybe among my book's readers, there will be a future Scarpa or someone who's lucky enough to practice architecture at its most extended level,
I agree. Well, like I said, I personally think that this can be brought in on any project, whether you're doing a house addition or a small coffee shop or a $60 million museum, all of that. Because the case is made that there are some really big firms that are kind of using parametric software, and again, I won't name any names, that kind of don't have as much soul or experientialism.
No, not at all.
So even they have the freedom and the money, and it's still not kind of being used properly in my mind.
Yeah. So listen, we all try to make a difference, right?
So yeah, as I said, you know, there's so much more, unfortunately. One thing is, I know you have plenty of other books as well, but you know, since the book's been published, what projects have you been working on? What's been keeping you busy?
You really want to know? A pool house for my brother-in-law, a house for some neighbors around the corner, which I think is going to come out great. Addition for another relative. I'm not going to claim to be a practitioner, but I have, over the years, I have about 12 projects around town that are residential and my own house, which is pretty nice. But I would stake my reputation, such as it is, as a writer and a teacher, and maybe a theorist. So.
Well, great.
I'm not expecting a Pritzker anytime soon.
Yeah, it's tough to get one of those.
Yeah.
Well, very interesting. Perhaps in the future we could talk about any of these other books I see here.
Yeah. Well, hopefully.
I wanted to thank you very much for being on the show with me today.
All right, Brian. I hope people enjoy.
For everyone listening, the book is Architecture Beyond Experience. Thank you and have a great day.
All right. Thank you.